Hello, this is Barbara Peters, and lucky me, I am sitting here with Reese Bowen, who today is about to sign Love and Death Among the Cheetahs, which is the, which number?
13th in the
lucky
series.
Lucky
13, yeah.
Excellent,
yeah.
Okay. I found, Reese, that this book was fascinating on several levels. Let's talk about one of the trivial ones, which was, how would you pack today to go to Africa, and how did she pack? Back then in 36, right?
End of 35. Yeah.
End of 35,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, the big problem is she doesn't have many clothes. She's just got married, so she does have some nice trousseau-type clothes, but highly unsuitable for Africa. She's told that the women there all wear trousers during the day because they tramp through the bush and everything, and they go on safaris. So she has to go and buy a pair of trousers, but she's not taking a maid for obvious reasons. You can't... A, she has an awful maid, the worst maid in the world, and B, she couldn't pay for her maid to be on a plane with them. So she's taking simple clothes, I think. But then she's told they all dress for dinner as if they're in England. They wear their backless evening dresses and their evening pajamas and things, just as they would in England, which is amazing. You're up in the middle of Africa, you're miles from civilization, and they dress for dinner.
Well, that was actually one of the parts I thought was so interesting, is that she was a lot more focused on dinner frocks and pajamas than she was on what she'd wear in the daytime. And I thought, boy, traveling today, it wouldn't even occur to you.
No.
You might take one dinner dress and not even a formal dress. Yeah. And then also, you know, jewels were another, because some of the women in the Happy Valley had extensive and interesting jewel collections.
Oh, they did. I mean, they dressed. The interesting thing is, it was a tiny little group. And they dressed up for each other all the time. And you think, what a waste, you know, why would you do this? Obviously, everybody's seen those emeralds last week, so why would you want to see them again? But I suppose, you know, the women were incredibly bored, I suppose. The men had the farm that they were running, and the women really had not very much to do during the day. So one of the things you do is get dressed up.
But do you think that that was in general a British colonial thing, was to try to recreate standards that would have applied at home wherever they were?
Absolutely. One of the books I read a lot of books for research. One of the books I read was The Diary of a Man Who'd Gone Out to Kenya in 1914 as a government officer. So he'd gone straight from university, 21-year-old, and he's put in charge of an enormous region. He's the only white man for about 50 miles. And what does he do? He puts on his dinner jacket for night, every dinner, in this mud hut. And his servant serves him dinner, and he sits there in the mud hut alone with his dinner jacket and his white tie and everything, because that's what one does. And you never lower the standards, because else they respect you less.
Did you think there was also a kind of fear of, quote, going native, unquote?
I don't know. I presume it happened sometimes. And, you know, there were some people, for example, who married Somali women or something, but I think on the whole, these are aristocrats, or they're very upper class people. And obviously they've come out because they were not the number one son, they were not the heir, they were the spare. And so they had nothing to look forward to in England. So they've come out here to make something of themselves. And sometimes they were the troublemaker, they were shipped out here to make something of themselves. So I think, you know, all that they've got is clinging to each other, really.
I asked that because some years ago I went on a trip to Italy with an opera group, and among the group was a really lovely woman from Malaysia who was very black and wore native costume, was gorgeous and whatever, and she was married to a man from Herefordshire who was practically an albino.
Oh.
And I thought, you know, as a couple they attracted absolutely no interest at all. And I thought that would not have been possible, you know, at the time you were writing about. And, you know, the going native thing is something I think I've read in books more about the Raj, about India, than maybe Africa.
Well, and also, I mean, in India you were dealing with a whole class that was quite educated anyway. You know, the upper class in India, or the middle class in India, who were clerks, etc., you were dealing with people who were educated, who could read, etc. Whereas here in Kenya, you're dealing with people who were very primitive. You know, they lived in their mud huts. They had their little plot of land with a couple of cows, and that was it.
Right. So there was no middle class of a bridge.
No. And that middle class was supplied by Indians. Anybody who was a clerk in East Africa came from India.
I brought that up because this is different than your other Lady Georgie books, and you have to write a disclaimer.
I did, yeah. And it is. A couple of reviews have already said, be warned, this one's darker than the rest. Well, I mean, it's not darker, but it's a little more thoughtful, I think. And I had to write a disclaimer because I think to our modern sensibilities, the way that the British treat the Africans is repugnant. They literally, you know, in those days, all the colonialists thought that they were bringing civilization and culture to primitive people, and they thought they were doing good. And obviously they did good for themselves in some cases too, but they treated the Africans at best as if they were children. And at worst, one of the examples, they had all male house servants. They made them wear white uniforms and perhaps a red fez and white gloves and stand behind the table and wait at table. In their culture, in the Kikuyu culture and the Somali, all the others, the man did no housework. That was the ultimate insult to him, to make him work in a house.
Right. So by doing that and leaving the women outside, they actually reversed the normal social order.
You did. And I mean, the problem was that by coming in like this as outsiders, they've suddenly created an economy driven by money rather than barter. And so people have to work because they need money now to buy food. And so you've got these people sort of trapped in this situation where they really don't want to be, and you're really emasculating the men because they would not have done anything like this.
So Georgie's an interesting point of view character for her to come out. She's always been, I don't want to, would you say naive or just maybe well-intentioned? She's
both, I think. She's grown up very sheltered.
Right.
And so she, the first few books, we know she's been incredibly naive. She's wised up a bit as we've gone along, but she's still, she believes in goodness, I suppose. She believes in the basic goodness of people, and she sees the best in people. And I think because she's an outsider, one half royal, the other half is a grandfather who has a little house with gnomes in his front garden. So she spans between two worlds, and that always makes you a good observer.
Yes, I think she's a wonderful character for you to show us the things that you want to show us. The other thing I think is really shocking to Georgie and may shock a lot of your readers is the lifestyle in the Happy Valley really could have put the whole Woodstock crowd to shame. Lots of drugs, lots of alcohol, wife swapping or lover swapping.
Yeah.
And Georgie is sort of plunged into that. I love the party that you sent her to where they're going to draw lots or something to see who's going to sleep with who.
Well, that was fun to do because I knew I'd read quite a lot anyway about the Happy Valley. So it was one of the reasons for sending her there, because I thought, if you bring completely naive Georgie, I mean, one of the scenes when they arrive for this party and they're shown to their room, and the first thing she notices is a mirror on the ceiling. And she says, oh, how really stupid. Why would you put a mirror on the ceiling? You can't see to do your hair properly. And when Darcy whispers what it is, then she's horrified. So I thought that'd be really fun. I like putting her out of her element a lot. But the thing was, the British aristocrats at home were not particularly moral.
Right.
You know, if you go back to the Prince of Wales, who was the son of Queen Victoria, he had a whole string of mistresses all his life. And then the current Prince of Wales, who's now with Mrs. Simpson, he's had a whole string of mistresses. And a lot of these people, they swapped women around quite often, or they swapped men around. And it was not really, because they lived above the morals of the middle class, I don't think it was really known by the middle class. And so they got on with their own little world, and they probably behaved in that way to a certain extent. And then you remove them from civilization, you remove them from the norms of society, and it's gone completely bonkers now, because one of the fun things to do is to wife swap. And they do this with great abandon. In fact, the Prince of Wales had come to Kenya in 1928, and this is one of the things I used in the book, and he had probably slept with every woman in the colony while he was there. So that's why some of them came to the party in the hope he might be there again.
I found that really interesting, because so much of the modern look at Edward and Wallace Simpson, you know, has her sexual hold on him, but maybe it was more psychological. But there's a lot of hinting that he wasn't perhaps really all that good as a lover, and that was one reason she had him so ensnared. So when we talk about him sleeping with all these women, you have to wonder, maybe it was just like a cuddle or something.
I don't think he was that good. He's always come across to me as a little bit effeminate, you know, very sort of lightweight.
Plus, there's no real rumor of bastards.
There is one. He went out to Australia when he was quite young.
Yeah.
And there was one young man there who claimed he was the Prince of Wales's son and actually did look an awful lot like him, but who knows?
How interesting. But nonetheless,
you know, might have managed it occasionally, you know.
Yeah, but I mean, for somebody that in theory, you know, yeah. was having a wonderful time every evening, he didn't leave a big trail of children, well, like Charles II, who had, you know, illegitimate children the length and breadth of England back in the 17th
century.
Well,
you know, if he couldn't perform very well, the woman would never have divulged that afterwards, because the kudos of sleeping with the Prince of Wales would have been rather good.
Really rather good. Plus they wouldn't have wanted to accept any personal blame or embarrassment. So you're right, it could well have been a kind of conspiracy, you know, just saying, well, wasn't really that good. I mean, because everybody is trying to understand, who's looked back on it, you know, the hold that Wallace Simpson had over him. I thought you did a very nice job in this and some previous books in portraying the way she ordered him around and, you know, broke through all the protocol basically treated him as though
she were
the nanny.
Yeah. Well, that's, I think that was part of the hold on him, was his own mother was so distant that I think that was partly a mother fixation, that he wanted someone to boss him around but to cuddle him to, and that's what she did. So I think she was the mother he never had.
I brought it up because one of Georgie has a mission on this trip to Kenya from Queen Mary, which is to keep an eye on David and hope that Mrs. Simpson's divorce has now gone through, right?
Yeah, it has. And so the Queen is terrified that they might get married in secret somewhere and then present it as a fait accompli. Like, what are you going to do about it? We're already married.
So Georgie is there with this little mission, and Darcy O'Meara, her new husband, is there. We don't know for sure why, but he clearly does a certain amount of
undercover
work.
Stuff. We're not quite sure what he does, but he seems to be given assignments from time to time.
Right. So while they're ostensibly here on a honeymoon, each of them actually has something else
to do,
to keep an eye on.
Yeah.
So I thought that worked well. Tell me a little bit about the research you did for the travel, because leaving from London, it's a 5-day trip by various vehicles to get to Kenya.
And I actually cheated, because in those days it could be up to 9 days.
Really?
Because, you know, planes could only fly about 200 miles and then they needed to refuel. And often, if you were out in some strange place, you had to have the refueling stuff brought on a camel or something like that. And so anyway, it's all authentic, because my father-in-law was one of the founders and heads of Imperial Airways. And he was actually on the first flight from London to Cape Town, and we have the letters he sent back from each stop along the way, so we know exactly what happened. And that's what you do. You fly to Basel, or sometimes they flew to Marseille instead and then took a flying boat across to Alexandria, but in this case they're flying to Basel in Switzerland. They then take a train through the Alps, because the Alps are so bumpy that everybody gets horribly airsick. And then from Brindisi you picked up the flying boat and you went across to Alexandria. And then they had built this aircraft called a Hannibal, which was a bigger version of the old Hadrians, the Hanley Pages. It had two big wings, and it could take about 40 passengers. Mostly it only took about 25, because they were the luxury passengers. And then it flew down. It flew to Alexandria, Cairo, Khartoum, Juba, and then Kimusu on the borders of Uganda and Kenya. And then it went on down to South Africa. But you'd fly that far, and then you'd stop, and then you'd be taken to a rest house while they refueled the plane and everything, and then you'd probably spend the night. I speeded it up a bit, because nothing happens on the flight, and I didn't want everybody to be bored that they went on to the next place, so I've skipped a few days. I've made my ground crews much more efficient than they were at the time.
Well, I can certainly understand that. It reminded me, Rob and I took the Canadian train, which is escaping me, but you'll probably remember it, that goes from Vancouver
through the Rockies
to Banff.
Yeah.
But it's not a sleeper train, so you get as far as Kamloops, and then you disembark, and
you have dinner
and spend the night in a Holiday Inn in Kamloops.
Oh, okay.
And then you get back on, it's the
Rocky Mountaineer, isn't it?
Yes, the Rocky Mountaineer, right. Yeah. And then so you're back on the train then for the next day. So while they can feed you on the train, they can't sleep you on the train. And I thought of that in this because it's the same problem for these flights.
It is, yeah. And I always think that's better than like the New Orient Express, that you have this lovely luxurious cabin, but then you're still bum 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 swayed around and things and going over points, and it's not very easy to sleep on a train, I don't find.
Well, no. And also enjoyed while they were on the plane. They got, you know, very nice meals. They were sitting in armchairs.
Yes.
In little groups. Nobody was really thinking about, you know, seatbelts and safety and all the kinds of things that we. But, I mean, you know, there was, it was much more luxurious.
If you see a picture of it, it looks like a train carriage, actually. It was like, you know, sort of velvet hangings on the walls and a nice big armchair and you know, and the steward coming up in his white jacket with a little tray, a silver tray on, handing them things. Just like air travel today, actually.
Right. So you've moved Georgie from, you know, desperately poor and looking for employment.
Yes.
Through various phases. And how does it feel now to have gotten her married to Darcy? Because that's been an arc for 12 books.
I know. It's a worrying thing, because obviously one of the things that was such fun is will they, won't they, and when will they? So now they're married. And so we've got to go on from there. And of course, the big thing that can be nice from now on is we know he does do some sort of undercover work. Is there going to be a time when he enlists her help? And she's the front person who's not undercover while he's quietly sleuthing behind her. That happens a bit in this book, of course, the excuse of the honeymoon to look at something that's a bit darker. So we can do that. I mean, there's all sorts of things I'd like to tackle with them. One of them is, of course, if she has a baby, will they have the nanny from hell, you know?
Yes, the nanny from hell, and they already have Queenie the maid from, right. So that'd be fun. I just had a thought. And we have her mother, who has been an on and off with a German industrialist, and we are moving more and more into the heavily Nazi era. So Mom is an interesting position.
Yeah, Mom has decided to go back to him. You know, his father died, and he had to go to running the business, and his own mother was a strict Lutheran who did not approve of George's mother. So he gave her up and decided he couldn't marry her. Then he has recently written to her saying he can't live without her, so she's gone rushing back to him. And I think we know that his factories are already starting to make things like tanks.
Right.
So we know that he might not be a Nazi himself, but he's certainly in the pocket of the Nazis. So is there going to come a time when Mummy finds herself trapped in Germany and maybe Georgie has to go and rescue her? That'd be a good story in the future.
That would be a very good story.
Yeah.
So I now remember what it was I was going to ask you. Georgie has been 35th in line for the throne, but she has had to renounce that formally in order to marry Darcy. So is she going to be liberated from some of the protocol that theoretically has governed her behavior up till now?
Theoretically, I mean, yes, she's quite free to do what she likes now. You know, she could get a job, etc. Of course, she's also had to give up being invited to state occasions and things, and maybe, you know, being part of the royal family had its nice side as well. But the interesting thing, she has to officially renounce because she married a Catholic, and that law was only changed when Princess Charlotte was born 2 years ago now. Yeah.
Right.
So until then, any member of the royal family line of succession could not marry a Catholic.
And when, of course, women didn't inherit if there were male heirs either, which
I think
is...
No, that was changed with Charlotte, too.
That law, if I remember right, was enacted when the first Hanoverian, when Queen Anne died, and the first Hanoverian king, which was, what, 1715?
Yeah.
And they, because that was George IV, if you remember, in theory married Mrs. Fitzherbert, who was a Catholic, and then it wasn't a legal marriage because he didn't... The succession law prevented him from doing that.
No, I mean, they had, from the time of Queen Elizabeth... they had many laws against Catholics and everything. I mean, John's family is one of the old Catholic families that kept the faith through the whole Reformation, and John's grandmother was born at Sutton Place, you know, the stately home.
Right.
And they had a little secret passage to a chapel in the woods where they would say Mass and things like that. And, you know, many occasions it was punishable by death, so you were very careful. You weren't allowed to keep horses, for example, so you couldn't gather a little army. So their neighbors would stable their horses for them. There were all sorts of things that went on till fairly recently.
John being your husband, for
those who don't know it.
I know you have a lot of background.
A lot of good stories for Lisa, for Georgie, actually.
Yeah, now for all of this. But the reason I asked was that one of the tensions in the books was that Georgie had to mind her P's and Q's as a royal. And now if she doesn't, you can introduce a different kind of tension. So there's a lot of springboards now that open up as a result of her marrying Darcy. So I think that we should look upon those rather than, you know, regret what's past.
Yeah, I mean, being royal really had no advantages for her apart from going to the odd thing at Buckingham Palace, which she was terrified of anyway in case she knocked something over, because she got no stipend. Like, you know, the royals nearer the throne actually got some sort of government stipend. She got no money, and yet she was expected to do things. Remember the time when the Queen foisted a Bavarian princess on her?
Yes.
And expected her to host the princess, never once thinking that Georgie was living on baked beans on toast. So, you know, she didn't get much out of being royal before, apart from the fact they wanted to marry her off to dubious princes around Europe.
So before we sign off, you have got a book coming out where you're looking at a different royal family, namely Queen Victoria.
Queen Victoria, yes, that's coming out next February. And I wanted to look into Queen Victoria's later years. In the book, she's 77. And I hadn't known before that during these years, every winter, she went to the south of France. And she took a huge retinue with her. She took all of her servants, all of her cooks. She took her bedroom furniture, including a vast bed and a mirror and a wardrobe. She had a private train. She took a regiment of Highland pipers. And then she said, "I don't want anybody to know I'm the Queen. You're to call me Lady Balmoral." Now, is it not a giveaway if you're walking through the street with a regiment of pipers going ahead of you? Everybody knew, of course, but so it was a fun time because she loved it so much there. And she felt very free there. She'd go on picnics, and she had a little donkey cart that she'd take her grandchildren around in. And I think, you know, it was a huge weight off her shoulders there. In fact, when she was dying, when she was 81, she said to her doctor, "If I could just go back to Nice, I know I'd be well."
That is the tribute, right? Yeah. She liked Balmoral for the same reason, I've always thought, she felt much freer up in Scotland.
Yeah. I think that's true of all the royals since. They've loved to go to Balmoral because there's no one within reach.
Right. I don't know if the modern people keep up Osborne House, but she would also go down to the Isle of Wight.
It's a museum now. It's not used by them at all. No.
Okay. Yeah. But in other words, she had several places that she could go to kind of escape
and
be
Marie Antoinette playing shepherdesses, you know.
It is very much the same way. Yeah. So, as a final teaser, you mentioned that big part of your book about Victoria was that you've had cookbooks and you are introducing the staggering meals that they consumed.
I couldn't believe when I saw the lunch menus, and you saw they went through maybe 20 something courses at lunch. Obviously they didn't eat everything of all of them, but they were all available. The five soups, there might be snipe, there might be hare, there might be duck, there might be lamb kidneys, and then the next course would be haunch of venison, and this is lunch we're talking about, and then you've got all the desserts and then the savouries. It's no wonder I saw her dress at Kensington Palace when I was there this summer. Her dress is wider than it is high.
Well, she was quite short, but even so, I get it. Well, this has been fun. I'm really looking forward to February and the Victoria book, which is called?
It's going to be called Above the Bay of Angels because it's set in Nice.
Nice, not Los Angeles.
Nice, not Los Angeles.
Okay. Thank you, Reese.
Thank
much.
You. Bye.